Well, the state of Alaska has just one seat in the U.S. House. Who would best serve the future of Alaska in that position? This time around, it's Democrat Harry Crawford who seeks that job. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. What is the case for a Democrat in the U.S. House? Our phone number, 1-800-478-8255-478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage of 550-8422, email talk@APRN.org. Harry Crawford and his vision for the future of Alaska and our relationship with the federal government on Talk of Alaska, statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Condor Airlines, offering nonstop service to Frankfurt from Anchorage and Fairbanks between May and September, with connections to most German and European destinations. Details available at condor.com. And by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
Well, Representative Harry Crawford is with us, and he's running for the U.S. House. Harry, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Good morning, Steve.
So let's see, your district that you served in the state house in Anchorage was Swear. What neighborhood?
It's the Chugach Foothills and Scenic Park and over to Baxter, the Baxter Bog area. I like to tell people it's where the big curve is, where Muldoon turns into Tudor.
And you decided to make this run. You know how things can go for Democrats in this House race. We got one person in the House. He's been there for a long time. Granted, it has been some ethical questions. But is it going as you anticipated, your campaign?
Oh, you know, when we started this, we didn't know exactly how it was going to go. When I started running in 1996 against Ramona Barnes, people told me that I could not win. It was an overwhelmingly Republican district, that she had more money than she knew what to do with, and that there was just no possible way that I was going to knock off a Speaker of the House that had been in the legislature for 20 years. And you see that I did get into the legislature. And I've run some tough races since then. In an overwhelmingly Republican district, one race, the first one that I ran for re-election, I ran against Don Young's son-in-law. He also had tons of money, and I prevailed. So I like a challenge.
Well, yeah, and you've got one. Now, why don't you give us some idea of what Alaskans would get if they would choose you in this election? I take it you're going to be, as seems like everybody that runs for statewide office is, pro Anwar drilling, mm-hmm. and probably have some ideas about how we can get that gas line.
Yep, and you know, everybody's got their idea about how to get the gas line. I've actually tried to do something about that, and you know, what I want people to know is what they'll get in me is really the antithesis to Don Young. You know, he is the epitome of the corporate congressman. You can look at his FEC reports. You can tell where he gets his money from, what he focuses on, the legislation that comes from that. You know, there's a responsibility, you know, to the people that help you get into office. I've gotten small donations from over 1,500 Alaskans, and I have a responsibility to them. And it's not to big corporations. You can look anywhere on my FEC reports. There's no, you know, nothing to track any corporations on there because they're just not there. And the way I feel, you know, if you lay down with dogs, you're bound to get some fleas. And Don Young has been there with Bill Allen, a businessman in Florida by the name of Daniel Aronoff, and Jack Abramoff. All these guys are, you know, have gone to jail, have been busted for tampering with our political system. And I've been 180 degrees away from that. You know, Vico actually came to my office the very first session that I served in the legislature. They stayed about 5 minutes, left, and have never come back. Yeah, it was pretty obvious to them, you know, which side I was on. And it wasn't the side of corporations that are just trying to make more money. I'm on the side of working people, Alaskans. That's my focus.
You come from an organized labor background.
Oh yeah.
I don't think there's any. I'm not saying anything out of school or anything to say you want jobs for Alaskans.
Right.
You understand that that takes investment. So where do you draw the line? I mean, in a lot of ways, it's corporations that are going to make those investments, right? Whether you're talking the oil industry and whether they choose Alaska over someplace else to make their investment, whether it's the mining industry or the timber industry, construction. I think one big argument for the Young campaign is getting highway money for Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
So where would the jobs come from for the Alaska that you envision?
Mm-hmm. You know, I come from Louisiana, place where the Longs came from, Huey Long, Russell Long, those folks. And one of the things that Russell Long said when he was in the U.S. Senate for about 36 years was chairman of the Senate Finance Committee and the originator of a lot of ideas like, the ESOP, the Employee Stock Ownership Plan, and the 401k style retirement. Those were all his babies. And he said, the only thing wrong with capitalism is there not enough of them. And I believe that owners make the best workers and workers make the best owners. And that's the reason why I'd like to get, the people that do the work also involved in the ownership. And, we've had several instances where that's actually happened. There was a railroad called the CN&W Railroad, Chicago and Northwestern Railroad. Once the employees of that railroad took over, it became the cheap and nothing wasted railroad, and it was very successful because the employees were also the owners, and that's the reason why in 2004 I put forward the idea that Ethan is championing now about having Alaskans invest in the gas pipeline. And I said, I came up here to work on the oil pipeline back in 1975. I made a lot of money. For that period of time, it was a lot of money. All of that's gone. And if I had deferred, say, 20% of my wages at that time, and gotten a tiny little piece of the ownership in that pipeline, not only would I be sitting much prettier, but my kids would, my grandkids would. I mean, that's where the benefit is in the ownership. So those are the sort of things that I'd like to put forward is get American workers also involved in the ownership of American production.
Well, I hate to say it, but I think they call that socialism.
No. Socialism is where the government owns the means of production. I want private ownership, not government ownership. There's a big distinction there.
I see. So let's say we got a prominent entrepreneur in Anchorage that has like profit sharing. That's the beginning, right? Mm-hmm. And then we had when the Carr family decided to sell their store out, they said, well, we really like to keep going this way it is. So they set up an employee stock ownership plan. I'm sure you're acquainted mm-hmm. with this. And what happened? The stock price went down for whatever reason. The stock price went down, and all of a sudden, the ESOP needed to sell out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I've seen that happen before with employee-owned enterprises.
Yeah. I mean, not every one of them has worked, and for a variety of reasons. You know, the United Airlines one didn't go well at all. But I think it was because they never, I mean, the management there didn't want to have a partial ownership by the workers.
So you really studied this. This is a solid plank in your platform, not just campaign
talk. Oh, it's been the last 30 or 40 years. You know, we go back to my economics classes back in the 70s.
Well, yeah, it's fascinating. And you would like remember Youngstown Sheet and Tube, for instance. And it would appear to me that basically what happened with some of these things is that the big corporate interests don't really care for employee-owned companies and tend to, like, use competitive pressures to try and get them run out of business.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So what do you do about that, Harry?
More ownership. That's, you know, you're just going to have to get to the point where there's a real say for the worker owners. But, you know, That's just one fairly esoteric side of why I'm running.
Yeah, and it came up in the context of generating jobs.
Right, and you know I did reserves tax along with Eric Croft, and I believe that if we had passed that reserves tax, that we would be building a gas line today, because that would have changed the economics of that project to where it was more expensive for them to leave the gas in the ground than it was to get it to market. All we were going to do was tax the gas in the ground for every year they didn't get a gas pipeline built, and then give them all the money back once that we got the gas to market. And I believe that it'd still work.
Harry Crawford is our guest. He is running as a Democrat for the U.S. House against Don Young. U.S. House seat comes up for election every 2 years. And Harry is running against Don Young, and he's on a platform, I say, of what we've learned so far is job creation through encouraging worker ownership, taking a look at our tax structure. Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. A lot of policy area questions are coming in, Harry, about various issues of national policy. You ready to start looking at these?
Oh, you bet.
All right. I'm going to start with the Arctic issue. Alaska has a lot of the Arctic coast, and yet it's like a state that people don't hardly even know where it is.
Mm-hmm.
And every other Arctic nation is making huge investments, and none is being made in the United States at all. This can't really continue.
No. I agree.
But how do we get here from there? I mean, is it funding for the Coast Guard? I mean, where do you start? We know that Senator Begich had his ideas to get it started, so I wanted to give you a chance on that.
Well, you know, Shell would like to put some investment in the Arctic. And we'd also like Phillips to get into the NPRA. All these jobs and ANWR, they're needed by Alaska. They're needed by the U.S. And we can do them responsibly. But that doesn't mean that we can cut financial corners like they were doing in the Gulf of Mexico. That was an absolute disaster, a travesty. And our regulators weren't minding the store. We need to make sure that we're doing our absolute best to do these things responsibly, but we need to move forward with them. We need maybe two blowout preventers on each well. Maybe we need, you know, two wells being drilled at a time. It may be a lot more expensive to do it right, but let's do it right so that we're not faced with another disaster, because in the Arctic, in an icy condition, I don't know that we could clean it up.
Yeah. There's like, this is a, like a really raw policy area right now. I think what Shell is offering to do is like kind of in a different universe than what our regulators are used to. Mm-hmm. And it's taken that they don't really quite even know how to react to it. You know, they're saying, well, you know, the Coast Guard can't be there. We'll have our own response fleet. Yeah, we'll drill in such a way that we can immediately plug the well. I mean, they kind of... they're a little bit ahead of the industry in the Gulf, it would appear, in the technology that they're offering in this frontier area. And it seems that the regulatory apparatus is just sort of frozen right now. They don't quite know what to do with it.
Yeah. I think that it's been a mindset over the last decade or so to really have a laissez-faire mineral management service. And they've just kind of backed off and let the industry handle it themselves. And, you know, I think that BP even has better practices in the North Sea than what they were employing in the Gulf of Mexico. I mean, that's what I've been told anyway. I believe that we can do these things better. I think we can do them more responsibly. Yeah, it's going to cost some more money. But, you know, I'm sure that BP would love to be able to go back to last April and start this all over again. They wouldn't be trying to save a couple of million dollars, which is probably going to lose them billions.
Yeah. But it appears that there's a, I don't know, one member in the U.S. House of 435 people, 438, I guess, right?
435, but then you've got the protectorates, I mean, or territories.
Yeah. It, you know, so there's one voice in all those other voices.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's this big old White House that is ignoring Arctic issues of any kind, pretty much, like with the icebreakers and whatnot. But particularly on this oil and gas thing, it just appears that they're kind of just slow rolling the thing. They haven't, ever since the Obama administration got in, it's like they can't figure out what to do about it, especially after this thing in the Gulf of Mexico happened. It's like, how do you get their attention? I know Don Young's tactic,
mm-hmm.
you know, which yeah. is to holler.
Right. Yeah, he does use the bully pulpit in a, you know, a bully kind of way.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, well, it can be. And, yeah, I think he'd admit to that.
That's not been my way of going about things. In the 10 years that I've been in the legislature, I've made friends and had relationships with people on both sides of the aisle. I've gotten a dozen or so bills passed through, every one of them in conjunction with the Republicans. You know, only one bill out of all of those that I ever got just in my name alone, they were always, you know, with Republican co-sponsors or, you know, I would hand it over to a Republican sponsor. I mean, Ralph Samuels and I worked together to get the alcohol ID bill passed. So that's the same sort of thing that I would do there.
You would depart from the Pelosi line, maybe?
Well, I think that if you ask anybody, and you know yourself, that I've always gone my own way in the legislature. It hasn't been a Democratic way. It hasn't been a Republican way. It's been a common sense way.
Okay. Harry Crawford's our guest. It's Talk of Alaska, talk@APRN.org. Telephone 1-800-478-8255. And let's start with the calls then, Harry. Here's Helen, joins the program from Bethel. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Harry Crawford.
Thank you for taking my call, Mr. Heimel. And thank you, Harry Crawford. Your name sounds like a Californian name or like something you read in a book. But I wanted to talk to you about subsistence.
Yes.
You have all these huge other countries that have huge ships and they're taking fish that migrate. We have, like, and the climate change issues. I'm proud of my district because they sent my son, he's 16, and they competed with all the young Alaskans from all the schools on climate change. I wanted to talk to you about subsistence the fish regulations and, you know, the hunting regulations. Most of them are, like, on federal and state land, and it's hard for, like, people who rely on subsistence to, they have to get a job instead of living on subsistence anymore, and it's changing culture. And the other issue I wanted to talk about is the Mental Health Trust Fund. We have so much money in there, and we have such a high suicidal, high everything, because we're such a remote, huge state. And also one more, I taught for 10 years, and that No Child Left Behind is not working for Alaskans. I mean, it's more like geared for lower 48.
You've got a lot of issues there,
right? Yes, I do. And on natural resources, we have lots. We just need to take care of our land, and nobody's doing that anymore. It's like it's hurting our subsistence and our plastic bags. I mean, I got too many issues. Thank you.
All right. Helen, thank you for your call to Harry Crawford. Let me start with the fisheries one and then go to the subsistence one. You know, what she's pointing to is the way that the Department of Fish and Game has been managing the salmon catch. Basically, they didn't let enough king salmon get up the river into Canada, and then they had to all make up for that in 1 year. And the result was that even subsistence fishing was curtailed. And it seemed sort of insensitive to the people that live there because, you know, there's not that much cash economy. You've got to get that fish in the fall.
Right.
And so she's just worried, and she's wondering what you on the federal level could have done about that.
And I'll tell you, you know, it's a worrisome situation. I was out in Bethel earlier this year and talked to a number of people. That was one of the things that was foremost on their minds. You know, subsistence is something that we have to do. We have to make sure that the people that live there, that have existed from that resource for generations after generations, can continue to. The thing is, though, it is a changing world. There are more and more people every day. And over the next few years, we're going to have 2 billion more people in the world. Some people are going to miss out. What I have to make sure as representative of Alaska is that our people don't miss out on what rightfully should be theirs. And when they're being intercepted before they can make it into the river, or if they're not allowed to fish because the upriver people are getting an inordinate amount of the share, then that's where the government has to step in and you know, take sides and make sure that
Now this would be Magnuson Act. This is basically that the Fish Council never did anything about the intercept fishery, and of course the industry would vehemently disagree with this. But essentially, it took them forever to get meaningful regulation on the catching of king salmon, the incidental catch of king salmon, because. They're composed of the Fish Council is basically representing the interests of the existing fishing industry.
Yeah, a lot of big processor catchers that this is just a business, and they're going to get every last dime of profit that they can get for this quarter, and they're not looking ahead. Where I believe that the people. In the Yukon, Kuskokwim Delta, you know, they're looking at their survival. And that's the side that I'm going to come down on.
Yeah. But it's hard to find the leverage on it because we got, I'm not even sure when Magnuson Stevens comes up for reauthorization.
There's I can't like tell you that either.
Or exactly what can be done. But, you know, for the most part, you know, I think, Do you favor the existing system of you know, through the council and all that for making the decisions?
Well, I really like the IFQ program. I mean the community
CDQ.
CDQ program. You know, where we're making sure that the people that have existed there because of that resource continue to be able to.
Mm-hmm. And before the call even comes in, how about the quota shares that basically there's marine conservation interests have decided that quota shares, to favor quota shares, even though it may not be the most prudent thing conservation-wise, but at least that way you don't have all of their different gear groups continuing to press for more allocation, because the overall allocation goes down from the, can be just brought down from the top that way.
Mm-hmm.
So they kind of like that situation. But the unintended consequences, I guess, in Alaska, we tend to see once you have a transferable ownership interest in the quota, it can be bought and sold. Mm-hmm. And pretty soon it ends up in Seattle or someplace.
Well, I think we need some safeguards there. And, you know, that's been a failing of the system. But the systems work fairly well about trying to protect the resource. So I'm sure that this will be a continuing battle over long after you and I are gone.
Yeah. It's Talk of Alaska, and Harry Crawford is our guest. He's running for U.S. House, and your questions are welcome at 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email is talk@aprn.org. Harry, are you pro-choice, or are you anti-abortion, or pro-life? Where do you stand there?
I am pro-choice. There were abortions before 1973, and if we were to make it illegal today, there would continue to be abortions. I don't want women to die from back out abortions. I want it to be safe, legal, but we need to work on stopping it from having the need. You know. education, access to birth control, all of those things, you know, to keep it from being something that is so prominent. I'm not going to go back from 1973 back to the way it was, but I would certainly like to get to a point where we're not doing it so often.
All right, Harry Crawford is our guest as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Are home heating costs more than you can manage? If you're living on a fixed income or reduced income, the Heating Assistance Program may be able to help. To obtain more information or an application form, visit the Heating Assistance Program website at heatinghelp.alaska.gov or call 1-800-470-3058. Sometimes a little help makes all the difference. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
It's Talk of Alaska. Our subject, the U.S. House, the future of Alaska. Harry Crawford running for U.S. House. 1-800-478-8255. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk@aprn.org. Well, let's see. Our delegation right now, we have Mark Begich, who was an aide to Tony Knowles when he was mayor. We have, we don't really know the House. We have Lisa Murkowski right now, and a hot run by Democrat Scott McAdams, who has taken an interesting position on tribal self-government rights, as did Tony Knowles. As governor, Tony Knowles recognized Alaska tribes. That's been pretty well ignored by the subsequent administration. Begich is neutral on this, as near as I can tell. But Scott McAdams is coming in and saying he thinks that tribes need to be recognized. Their jurisdiction rights need to be recognized because of the nature of the situation we have in rural Alaska, with the realistic lack of any kind of real presence by the state, and the increasing amount of federal jurisdiction being asserted. Where would you come down on this issue of tribal self-government rights?
I think that the reason why we went to corporations instead of tribes in the first place was a way to separate people from their traditional lands. And, you know, it in some ways it's worked fairly well, but in other ways it's I think, been woefully inadequate. And I have to agree with Scott that, you know, tribes are there. You know, whatever you call them, but they're there. The unit is there. So I think we should recognize them. You can't tell it by looking at me, but I'm part of the Pamunkey Indian tribe, one of the Algonquin, nation in Virginia. We have the oldest reservation in America. It's a tiny reservation. I think it may be the smallest reservation in America. I'm pretty proud of that. That heritage. When my ancestors came to Virginia, they found my other ancestors already there. And I think that, you know, we separated folks from their land. We separated them from their traditions. And I believe that, you know, we need to do a better job of keeping people connected with the land and their traditions and their way of life here.
Well, there are those at the AFN convention right now that are advocating for reopening the Native Claims Settlement Act to amend it in order to really make this happen. In other words, to make it clear that tribes do have jurisdiction over their land.
Mm-hmm.
How would you come down on that?
I'd like to see us move to something closer to that.
Now, let's take the Title VIII of ANILCA, which is the law that governs subsistence. It deliberately does not make a racial distinction.
Right.
There were those who were saying, well, the time has come when we really need to. We are in an interesting situation in Alaska right now because the courts have determined that Alaska's constitution is irreconcilable with Title VIII of ANILCA, and the result is that we have federal management, increasing amount of possible federal jurisdiction over our fish and game resources in the state of Alaska. The question is what to do about it.
Mm-hmm. And it's a sticky, sticky question. I mean, it's one of the reasons why I was able to defeat Ramona Barnes 10 years ago. It was because she was absolutely opposed to changing the Constitution to recognize that. But I think it's a fact of life here in Alaska, and that we need the Constitution that we passed wasn't infallible. You know, it didn't come down from Mount Sinai, and I think we can do better. So I want to make sure that we're not out of you called it an irreconcilable difference.
Well, no, opinions differ, but essentially it's the common use clause. And some say that there's ways of tweaking it with a constitutional amendment that really wouldn't infringe on rights, and then others are extremely adamant that this is no news to you. You,
right.
You sat there in the legislature during this controversy. but the fact of the matter is, as interpreted, the state constitution is irreconcilable.
Yeah. Well, I went through three special sessions on this, and it was obvious which side I was on then, and I still am. So,
okay. Let's go to Homer, where Tom joins the program. Tom, you're on the air with Harry Crawford.
Harry, thanks for taking my call. I've written down some items here that concern me that I'd like to have you discuss.
You're another one of those with a list. Now, how many are there, Tom? Do you have four?
Well, I've got seven, but two.
You think you could?
Any number that you've got time for.
All right, let's try it. Let's try the top one.
Top one is the hundreds of military bases we got and the two wars we got going on. I'd like to know his position on that.
Oh, you know, I think that one of the reasons why the U.S. has not moved forward on manufacturing and new research and development in so many areas is because we spend so much money on our military and projecting our military power around the world. And what I believe is that the only time that we should ever commit ground troops anywhere in the world is when there's a clear and present danger to the U.S. or, you know, U.S. Interests. So I believe that maybe we could have done something a little different than invade Afghanistan and Iraq and Vietnam and a number of other things over the years. I don't think that military power ought to be our first option. I think it ought to be our last option. I just don't want to see, you know, all of our wealth and our young people being, all of that being put towards military power.
Okay, Tom, another question?
I was wondering about if he supports the 2,700-page health plan that the Congress has approved.
Oh, yes, Obamacare, with all its warts and all. Is there anything there at all that you would favor? Is there? What do you think? Can it be salvaged?
Well, there were a number of things that it corrected on the abuses of the insurance companies that I like, but I just hate the part where, you know, it makes insurance, you know, that where we have to buy it, without ever attacking the root cause of the problem, which is the cost of health care. That's where we've got to focus on, is the inordinate amount of money it costs for health care in this country. We spend more of our gross national product on healthcare than any other place in the world, and sometimes without nearly as good an outcome as they have elsewhere. So we spend about 27 cents out of every healthcare dollar on insurance, where many countries, there's only 1 to 2% overhead for the actual administration of paying for healthcare. So we've got to do something better, and this bill was not it. I mean, this bill, like I've said many times in all of my literature that I've put out, there are answers to all our problems, but we get confused by our leaders get confused by the big money that comes from these big corporations. They forget how to vote because they're trying to please their masters, you know, that are given the big checks. And that's, you don't have that problem with me.
All right, Tom, if you want to stay on the line, that would be fine. But I do want to relay an email question, and we'll get back to another one of yours. Would that be okay, Tom?
That'd be fine. Thank you.
All right. Just stay right on the line. This one comes from... This is from Klondike Kelly, who says, are you ready to start criticizing the Democratic administration's Department of Justice and the way that they've been handling the parameters of corruption? In other words, something that was illegal a few years ago is no longer illegal. Isn't that why Don Young's charges were dropped? And this Justice Department under Eric Holder has let one Republican after another off the hook. So what gives? And how has this affected your race since Don Young is no longer under investigation?
Yeah, you know, that's a huge frustration for me, and I don't understand, you know, how we can have, you know, sworn testimony that They've accepted more than $200,000 in illegal campaign contributions, never reported it, and there's no repercussions. And when we called and asked, the Justice Department just gave us no comment, no comment, and no comment. I don't know what's going on, and I certainly am not on the inside where I can find out what's going on. So I don't understand what's going on with the Obama Justice Department.
Well, are you making an issue of it? I don't sense that you really are. That this is your campaigning and saying, look, and you know, regardless of whether there's prosecution or not, there's wrongdoing here, and you need a better man. And I don't hear you saying that kind of thing.
Well, I've been trying to focus on what would be different if I were in the Congress. And I mean, I am going there to represent Alaskans, not big corporations, not big money special interests. That's just the long and the short of it. I don't like what Don Young's done under the system that we had. I think it was wrong. It's the reason why Eric Croft and I did the campaign finance reform initiative here in Alaska. You know, it passed more than 2-1. We've got the strongest campaign finance laws in the country right here in Alaska because of that initiative. And I think that our system is fouled up, you know, to be really blunt about it. I think that it's almost like legal bribery when you know, the Chuis family in Louisiana has just showered Don Young with cash this election cycle. I believe he had to hand back about $16,000 to some of the Chuis family cousins because they overpaid. It's just wrong. We've got a couple of boatyards here in Alaska that need the work, where he's out there advocating for this boatyard in Gonzales, Louisiana. I don't know, you know, exactly what the quid pro quo is here. I just know that he's out there advocating for him, and they've showered him with more than $50,000 in cash in this election.
So that's about as negative as you're going, then.
That's about it.
Thank you. Tom and Homer.
Another issue is, it's my understanding that if we developed 5% of our agricultural effort into petroleum needs, it would supply it for the United States in the term of other source of fuel. And this business of drilling under the ice is extremely dangerous, I think, for pollution. What's your position on these?
If you could explain that first part of the question a little better, I'm still not clear what you were talking about.
Okay, well, what I'm saying is agriculture, like Brazil, supplies their fuel needs. And in this country, it's my understanding that if we had 5% of our agricultural land used for petroleum use, that it would supply our needs, the entire country. And what we're doing, we're in the Arctic, we're drilling under the ice, which is extremely dangerous for pollution purposes. And I just wanted you to discuss that business of drilling under the ice a little bit, what your position is.
Well, this is the first time I've ever heard that 5% of our agricultural land towards, ethanol production or something like that, would take care of all our needs. That's kind of an amazing statistic to me, because I've never heard that anywhere else, and I've done a fair amount of studying here.
Okay. Well, there's a book out on it, Alcohol is a Gas, by David Bloom. I think that's where it came from.
Okay. Well, I'd have to read more on that. I mean, this is certainly not something that I've heard. What I do advocate for is to move to a renewable energy economy where we use hydrogen for storage or anhydrous ammonia or some medium like that to store that energy and to be able to transport it to the places that we need it. I actually got to drive a hydrogen fuel cell powered car in Washington, D.C. 2 or 3 years ago. That was quite the experience, but you know, they're not something that's mass-produced, so they're very, very expensive. They said that the copy that I was driving was about $1 million, but it worked really well, and I'd like to have one, but not on my wages. Let me see.
Drilling under the ice.
Yeah. You know, I think it's fraught with a lot of problems. And, you know, the way they've done this in other occasions is to build islands to drill from. Maybe they could build a concrete and steel encasement to protect it from the ice. It's going to be more expensive to drill in the Arctic in a responsible manner than what we've done so far. So I'm not going to risk renewable resources for non-renewable resources. We've got to make sure that we can protect our wildlife, our fish, first before we move forward with the drilling.
Tom and Homer?
Another question. We've got more people locked up than any country in the world, and I was wondering what your position is on this, locking people up in our prisons like we've got in this country.
Yeah, I'm amazed we got through so many of your questions.
Well, you know, you may not know about my bill, about the alcohol ID bill, but what I would like to focus on is prevention before the act happens. My wife was hit by a drunk driver coming out of church on Christmas Eve night in 2004, and it very nearly killed her. We almost lost her. And the guy that did it was a repeat offender, and he was a 0.35 blood alcohol content.
That's serious.
Yeah, most of us would be already in a coma at that point. So he'd been practicing at it for a while to get to the point where he could function somewhat at a blood alcohol content of 0.35. So now what we have, because of that, we have a bill that if you look at your driver's license, it probably has a blue stripe right across the middle of it. Now, if you're a repeat offender, it will have a red stripe there, and it will say alcohol restricted. If you go into a liquor store or bar and they ask you for your driver's license, it has a red stripe there. They confiscate it, hand it to the ABC board, the Alcohol Beverage Control Board, and there's a $1,000 fine from the offender that goes to the business as an incentive for them to check the driver's licenses. More and more and more across the state, they're checking driver's licenses. A lot of people get offended. They say, "Huh, I'm 60 years old. Do I look like I'm less than 21?" It's not about whether you're 21 or not. It's about whether you have an alcohol problem, and it's about whether you are a repeat offender, because more than a third of all the accidents happen because of the repeat offenders. If we could get, you know, 85% of the people that we have in the jails and prisons in Alaska are there on an alcohol-related offense. And if we could get alcohol out of the problem, out of the equation, we'd have a lot less people locked up.
Tom, I want to thank you so much for your questions. You're doing my job for me. Thank you so much, Tom and Homer.
Okay, thank you.
All right, it's Talk of Alaska with Harry Crawford, 1-800-478-8255, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk@APRN.org as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century, member FDIC, equal housing lender, and by
Fire Island Wind, offering a renewable energy alternative to natural gas for South Central Alaska. Information at fireislandwind.com.
Hello, I'm Peter Kenyon, NPR foreign correspondent and former APRN reporter. Help support APRN's news mission by joining me on October 24th for the first of the new APRN speaker series. Go to APRN.org to reserve your ticket today.
It's Talk of Alaska, a special election edition, and more of them coming next week. This time we're with Harry Crawford running for the U.S. House against incumbent Republican Don Young. Harry Crawford, we got a call from Caroline in Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Caroline.
Thank you so much. Steve, good programs as always. Mr. Crawford, you mentioned so many things have come up that people are concerned about. You could spend one item per day for your entire time in Congress, and you wouldn't get through all of them.
Oh, no, I know it.
especially since, what is their work week, Tuesday through Thursday? But anyway, the thing you touched on, which I think deserves a strong look-see, is the right of the villages versus the corporations. We know in the corporations and in the world that we deal in all the time that the stockholders have so much difficulty in changing the leadership. And one specific story that just really got my temperature up happened recently in the Bethel region, where I traveled some years back. I traveled through a number of those villages, and it was that a man was fired from his position. He was the top person in the corporation. He had been accused of stalking, and they listed his salary at over $700,000 a year. Now, how much could that do in the villages? And yet the villages can't seem to get the corporations to shake loose any money to pass down for indoor plumbing, for any number of things. So the folks are still using the technology in terms of health and sanitation that they had centuries ago. So again, these are vital things to Alaska. And you mentioned money, clean elections. I know you were in favor of that. And I had the only thing this nonpartisan has ever stood with trying to gather signatures for. And people said to me, well, I don't want the government paying for politicians to get elected. And I said, you're paying for it 100 times over through the graft and corruption that exists under the current system. So, again, where do you stand on clean elections? And thank you for anything you can do to give the strength to the villages and not to the corporate offices where obscene, apparently, if this is any kind of standard, obscene amounts of money are paid to the top officials.
Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely, I believe, is the old adage. And I hate to see any structure set up that doesn't have a check and balance system. And I don't really know about the case that you're talking about. It's not something that's been tried in the courts yet, so I'm not going to, pursue that any farther. I think that we need to set up structures that do have checks and balances and are watched more closely. It's one of the failings of the corporate system, because the people at the top have an inordinate amount of power. And I believe that here in Alaska, we did well when we passed the Campaign Finance Reform Act. We've done it twice. We do have the strongest campaign finance laws, and it's what has made it more the legislature more equitable here. When I got into the legislature, the numbers became 27 to 13. Before that, it was the dirty dozen, 28 to 12. Everything was very unbalanced. Now it's 22 to 18 in the House. And I think that campaign finance reform is what helped make that happen, or at least in part. Because when you could give a $1,000 check as an individual, or a $2,000 check as a corporate PAC or a union PAC, it gave an inordinate amount of power to those big donors. I know I've been calling and asking people to help me in this campaign, and I get contributions $50 and $100. Most often that's what comes. When, you know, that takes 10 to 20 of those to make up for one of those $1,000 checks. So I don't want to see an unbalanced system where the rich people are running the show for our politics here. So that's the reason why I was in favor of the campaign finance reform issue, and will continue to try to improve on it.
So you're pushing, you're all in favor of clean elections, basically. The idea that there's a voluntary system in which people can sign up or not, but if they do sign up, they get public funding, and you've got to find the source of money, that's all.
Well, I believe that the thing that we can actually get through is to limit the amount of the campaign contribution, because I don't believe that we have the wherewithal in the public to go to government financed elections. Mm-hmm. I believe that it showed, I mean, that was shown in our last election that we tried. So
is there anything that can be done to deal with what Caroline is talking about in the other situation with the native regional corporations somehow might be making money, and yet the prosperity doesn't seem to be reflected on the village level?
Well, that's where the people that are able to vote for their boards of directors and all need to step up and become more involved. And it's, when they set up
these
corporations.
That's easier said than done.
Absolutely. I mean, when they set those corporations up, you know, the people that were doing the voting weren't, they'd never been in that position before. So it wasn't something they were used to. But they're becoming more and more sophisticated every year. And I hear those arguments at AFN.
Yeah, got to finish up here, Harry.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, I think we're improving.
Okay. Harry Crawford, I want to thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
All right. Harry Crawford running for U.S. House. More of them coming next week and talk of Alaska. It's Pat Yak on the phones, Dave Waldron at the controls. Thank you very much to BD Trantina on the telephones. I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. The Federal Aviation Administration sets rules for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, and when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message is sponsored by the FAA. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a pre-existing medical condition, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the new temporary federal insurance program being administered by ACHEA, the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. The program is for those with qualifying pre-existing conditions and who have been uninsured for at least 6 months. Talk to an independent insurance broker or go online to ACHIA.com. This message sponsored by ACHEA Fed. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.